When we switch gears, we in effect move the problem that we have been trying to solve from our conscious brain to our unconscious. While we may think we are doing something else, and indeed our attentional networks become engaged in something else, our brains don't actually stop work on the original problem. We may have left our attic to smoke a pipe or play a sonata, but our staging area remains a place of busy activity, with various items being dragged into the light, various combinations being tried, and various approaches being evaluated. The key to diagnosing Watson's inability to create distance between himself and a case may well be that he hasn't found a suitably engaging, yet not overwhelming activity as a substitute. In some instances, he tries reading. Too difficult of a task. Not only does he fail to concentrate on the reading, thereby losing the intent of the activity, but he can't stop his mind from returning to the very thing he shouldn't be thinking about. And yet for Holmes, reading is indeed a suitable distancing method. Polyphonic motets of Lassus, anyone? Other times, Watson tries sitting in contemplation. Too boring, as he himself puts it. He soon finds himself almost nodding off. In either case, the distancing fails. The mind is simply not doing what it is supposed to do, dissociating itself from the present environment and thus engaging its more diffuse attentional network, that same default network that is active when our brains are at rest. It's the opposite of the distraction problem that we encountered in the last chapter. Watson now can't be distracted enough. What he should be doing is distracting himself from the case, but instead, he is letting the case distract him from his chosen distraction, and so failing to get the benefit of either concentrated thought or diffuse attention. Distraction isn't always a bad thing. It all depends on the timing and type. Interesting fact. We get better at solving insight problems when we are tired or intoxicated. Why? Our executive function is inhibited, so information that would normally be deemed distracting is allowed to filter in. We thus become better at seeing remote associations. The last chapter was all about mindless distraction. This, on the contrary, is mindful distraction. But for it to work, it's essential to choose the right activity, be it the pipe, or the violin, or an opera, or something else entirely. Something that is engaging enough that it distracts you properly, and yet not so overwhelming that it prevents reflection from taking place in the background. Once you find your sin of choice, you can term the problems and decisions you face accordingly. 3 pipe, 2 movement, 1 museum visit. You get the idea. In fact, there's one activity that is almost tailor-made to work. And it is a simple one indeed. Walking. The very thing that Holmes was doing when he had his insight in the lion's mane. Walks have been shown repeatedly to stimulate creative thought and problem-solving, especially if these walks take place in natural surroundings, like the woods, rather than in more urbanized environments. But both types are better than none, and even walking along a tree-lined street can help. After a walk, people become better at solving problems. They persist longer at difficult tasks, and they become more likely to be able to grasp an insightful solution, like being able to connect those 4 dots you saw earlier. And all from walking past some trees and some sky. Indeed, being surrounded by nature tends to increase feelings of well-being, and such feelings, in turn, tend to facilitate problem-solving and creative thinking, modulating attention and cognitive control mechanisms in the brain in a way that predisposes us to engage in more Holmes-like imagination. Even the walk can, at times when the pressure seems just too high to handle, so that, like Watson, you can't even begin to contemplate doing something else, be forfeited in favor of looking at screenshots of natural scenes. It's not ideal, but it just might do the trick in a pinch. Showers are likewise often associated with imaginative thought, facilitating the same type of distance as Holmes's pipe or a walk in the park. You can shower for only so long, however. A 3-pipe problem would signify quite the shower ahead of you. In such cases, the walk might be the better solution. Ditto listening to music. Holmes's violin and opera in action, and engaging in visually stimulating activities, such as looking at visual illusions or abstract art. In every case, that diffuse attentional network is able to do its thing. As our inhibition is lowered, the attentional network takes over whatever is bothering us. It ramps up, so to speak, for whatever comes next. It makes us more likely to grasp remote connections, to activate unrelated memories, thoughts, and experiences that may help in this instance to synthesize the material that needs to be synthesized. Our unconscious processing is a powerful tool, if only we give it the space and time to work. Consider a classic problem-solving paradigm known as compound remote associates. Look at these words: crab, pine, sauce. Now try to think of a single word that can be added to each of these to form a compound or a two-word phrase. Done? How long did it take? And how did you come about your solution? There are two ways to solve this problem. One comes from insight, or seeing the right word after a few seconds of searching, and the other comes from an analytical approach, or trying out word after word until one fits. Here, the proper answer is apple, crabapple, pineapple, applesauce, and one can arrive at it either by seeing the solution or going through a list of possible candidates. Cake? Works for crab, but not for pine. Grass? Ditto. Etc. The former is the equivalent of picking out those items in the opposite corners of your attic and making them into a third related yet unrelated thing that makes complete sense the moment you see it. The latter is the equivalent of rummaging through your attic slowly and painfully, box by box, and discarding object after object that does not match until you find the one that does. Absent imagination, you're stuck with that second, not very palatable alternative, as Watson would be. And while Watson might get to the right answer eventually, in the case of a puzzle like the word associates, in the real world, there's no guarantee of his success, since he doesn't have the elements laid out in front of him as nicely as those three words: crab, pine, sauce. He hasn't created the requisite mind space for insight to even be possible. He has no idea which elements may need to come together. He has, in other words, no conception of the problem. Even his brain will be different from Holmes's as he approaches the problem, be it the word association or the case of the builder. At first glance, if Watson were to come to the right answer on his own, we might not see an immediate difference. In neither Holmes or Watson's case, a brain scan would show us that a solution has been reached approximately 300 milliseconds before the solver realizes it himself. Specifically, we would see a burst of activity from the right anterior temporal lobe, an area just above his right ear that is implicated in complex cognitive processing, and an increased activation in the right anterior superior temporal gyrus, an area that has been associated with perceiving emotional prosody, or the rhythm and intonation of language that conveys a certain feeling, and bringing together disparate information in complex language comprehension. But Watson may well never reach that point of solution, and would likely know he's doomed long before he himself does. While he's struggling with the puzzle, we would be able to predict if he was heading in the right direction by looking at neural activity in two areas: the left and right temporal lobes, associated with the processing of lexical and semantic information, and the midfrontal cortex, including the anterior cingulate, associated with attention switching and the detection of inconsistent and competing activity. That latter activation would be particularly intriguing, as it suggests the process by which we're able to gain insight into a preciously inscrutable problem. The anterior cingulate is likely waiting to detect disparate signals from the brain, even weak ones that we are unaware of sending, and turning its attention to them to gain a possible solution, amplifying, so to speak, information that already exists, but that needs a little push to be integrated and processed as a general whole. In Watson's brain, we're not likely to see much action, but Holmes's would tell a different story. In fact, were we to simply compare Watson's brain to Holmes's, we would find telltale signs of Holmes's predisposition to such insights, and Watson's lack thereof, even absent a target for his mind to latch onto. We would discover that the detective's brain was more active in the right hemisphere regions associated with lexical and semantic processing than your average Watson brain, and that it exhibited greater diffuse activation of the visual system. What would these differences mean? The right hemisphere is more involved in processing such loose or remote associations as often come together in moments of insight, while the left tends to focus on tighter, more explicit connections. More likely than not, the specific patterns that accompany insight signal a mind that is ever ready to process associations that, at first glance, don't seem to be associations at all. In other words, a mind that can find connections between the seemingly unconnected can access its vast network of ideas and impressions and detect even faint links that can then be amplified to recognize a broader significance, if such a significance exists. Insight may seem to come from nowhere, but really, it comes from somewhere quite specific, from the attic and the processing that has been taking place while you've been busy doing other things. The pipe, the violin, the walk, the concert, the shower. They all have something else in common beyond the earlier criteria we used to nominate them as good potential activities for creating distance. They allow your mind to relax. They take the pressure off. In essence, all of the mentioned characteristics, unrelated, not too effortful, and yet effortful enough, come together to offer the proper environment for neural relaxation. You can't relax if you're supposed to be working on a problem, hence the unrelatedness. Nor can you relax if you're finding something effortful. And too lax, well, you may not be stimulated to do anything, or you might relax a bit too much and fall asleep. Even if you don't come to any conclusions or gain any perspective in your time off from a problem, chances are you will return to it both re-energized and ready to expend more effort. In 1927, Gestalt psychologist Bluma Zagarnik noticed a funny thing. Waiters in a Vienna restaurant could remember only orders that were in progress. As soon as the order was sent out and complete, they seemed to wipe it from memory. Zagarnik then did what any good psychologist would do. She went back to the lab and designed a study. A group of adults and children was given anywhere between 18 and 22 tasks to perform, both physical ones, like making clay figures, and mental ones, like solving puzzles. But half of those tasks were interrupted so that they couldn't be completed. At the end, the subjects remembered the interrupted tasks far better than the completed ones. Over 2 times better, in fact. Zagarnik ascribed the finding to a state of tension, akin to a cliffhanger ending. Your mind wants to know what comes next. It wants to finish. It wants to keep working. And it will keep working, even if you tell it to stop. All through those other tasks, it will subconsciously be remembering the ones it never got to complete. It's the same need for closure that we've encountered before. A desire of our minds to end states of uncertainty and resolve unfinished business. This need motivates us to work harder, to work better, and to work to completion. And a motivated mind, as we already know, is a far more powerful mind. Distancing through actual distance. And what if, like Watson, you simply can't fathom doing something that would enable you to think of something else, even if you have all of these suggestions to choose from? Luckily, distance isn't limited to a change in activity, though that does happen to be one of the easier routes. Another way to cue psychological distance is to acquire literal distance, to physically move to another point. For Watson, that would be the equivalent of getting up and walking out of Baker Street instead of sitting there looking at his flatmate. Holmes may be able to change location mentally, but an actual physical change may help the lesser-willed and could even aid the great detective himself when imaginative inspiration is not otherwise forthcoming. In The Valley of Fear, Holmes proposes to return in the evening to the scene of the crime under investigation, leaving the hotel where he has been doing most of his thinking. "An evening alone!" Watson exclaims. Surely that would be more morbid than anything else. "Nonsense," Holmes counters. It could actually be quite illustrative. "I propose to go up there presently. I have arranged it with the estimable Ames, who is by no means wholehearted about Barker. I shall sit in that room and see if its atmosphere brings me inspiration. I'm a believer in the genius loci. You smile, friend Watson. Well, we shall see. And with that, Holmes is off to the study. And does he find inspiration? He does. The next morning, he is ready with his solution to the mystery. How is that possible? Could the genius loci have really brought the inspiration that Holmes had hoped? Indeed, it could have. Location affects thought in the most direct way possible. In fact, it even affects us physically. It all goes back to one of the most famous experiments in psychology, Pavlov's dogs. Ivan Pavlov wanted to show that a physical cue, in this case it was a sound, but it can just as easily be something visual, or a smell, or a general location, could eventually elicit the same response as an actual reward. So he would ring a bell and then present his dogs with food. At the sight of the food, the dogs would, naturally, salivate. But soon enough, they began to salivate at the bell itself, before any sight or smell of food was present. The bell triggered the anticipation of food, and with it, a physical reaction. We now know that this type of learned association goes far beyond dogs and bells and meat. Humans tend to build such patterns as a matter of course, eventually leading innocuous things like bells to trigger predictable reactions in our brains. When you enter a doctor's office, for example, the smell alone may be enough to trigger butterflies. Not because you know there will be something painful. You might be coming in to drop off some forms, for all that. But because you have learned to associate that environment with the anxiety of a medical visit. The power of learned associations is ubiquitous. We tend, for instance, to remember material better in the location where we first learned it. Students who take tests in the room where they did their studying tend to do better than if they take those same tests in a new environment. And the opposite is true. If a particular location is tied to frustration or boredom or distraction, it doesn't make for a good study choice. At every level, physical and neural, locations get linked to memories. Places tend to get associated with the type of activity that occurs there, and the pattern can be remarkably difficult to break. Watching television in bed, for instance, may make it difficult to get to sleep. Unless, that is, you go to sleep while watching TV. Sitting at the same desk all day may make it difficult to unstick yourself if your mind gets stuck. The tie between location and thought explains why so many people can't work from home and need to go to a specified office. At home, they are not used to working, and they find themselves being distracted by the same types of things that they would normally do around the house. Those neural associations are not the ones that would be conducive to getting things, work-related things, that is, done. The memory traces simply aren't there, and the ones that are there aren't the ones you want to activate. It also illustrates why walking might be so effective. It's much more difficult to fall into a counterproductive thought pattern if your scenery is changing all the time. Location affects thought. A change in location cues us, so to speak, to think differently. It renders our ingrained associations irrelevant and, in so doing, frees us to form new ones, to explore ways of thinking and paths of thought that we hadn't previously considered. Whereas our imagination may be stymied by our usual locations, it is set loose when we separate it from learned constraints. We have no memories, no neural links that kick in to tie us down. And in that lies the secret link between imagination and physical distance. The most important thing that a change in physical perspective can do is to prompt a change in mental perspective. Even Holmes, who unlike Watson doesn't need to be led by the hand and forcibly removed from Baker Street in order to profit from some mental distance, benefits from this property. Let's return once more to Holmes's strange request in the Valley of Fear to spend his night alone in the room where a murder has taken place. In light of the link between location, memory, and imaginative distance, his belief in the genius loci no longer seems nearly as strange. Holmes doesn't actually think that he can recreate events by being in the room where they took place. Instead, he banks on doing precisely what we've just discussed. He wants to trigger a change of perspective by a literal change of location. In this case, a very specific location and a very specific perspective, that of the people involved in the crime at hand. In doing so, he frees up his imagination to take not the path of his own experiences, memories, and connections, but that of the people involved in the events themselves. What associations might the room have triggered for them? What might it have inspired? Holmes realizes both the necessity of getting into the mindset of the actors involved in the drama and the immediate difficulty of doing so, with all of the elements that could at any point go wrong. And what better way to push all distracting information to the side and focus on the most basic particulars, in a way that is most likely to recall that of the original actors, than to request a solitary evening in the room of the crime? Of course, Holmes still needs all of his observational and imaginative skills once he is there. But he now has access to the tableau and elements that presented themselves to whomever was present at the original scene of the crime. And from there, he can proceed on a much more sure footing. Indeed, it is in that room that he first notices a single dumbbell, surmising at once that the missing member of the pair must have somehow been involved in the unfolding events. And from that room that he deduces the most likely location of the dumbbell's pair, out the only window from which it could reasonably have been dropped. And when he emerges from the study, he has changed his mind from his original conjectures as to the proper course of events. While there, he was better able to get into the mindset of the actors in question, and in so doing, clarify the elements that had previously been hazy. And in that sense, Sherlock Holmes invokes the same contextual memory principle as we just explored, using context to cue perspective taking and imagination. Given this specific room, at this specific time of day, what would someone who is committing or had just committed the crime in question be most likely to do or think? Absent the physical change in distance, however, even Holmes may have found his imagination faltering, as indeed he did prior to that evening in failing to conceive of the actual course of events as one of the possibilities. We are not often trained to look at the world from another's point of view in a more basic, broad fashion that transcends simple interaction. How might someone else interpret a situation differently from us? How might he act given a specific set of circumstances? What might he think given certain inputs? These are not questions that we often find ourselves asking. Indeed, so poorly trained are we at actually taking someone else's point of view that when we are explicitly requested to do so, we still proceed from an egocentric place. In one series of studies, researchers found that people adopt the perspective of others by simply adjusting from their own. It's a question of degree rather than type. We tend to begin with our own view as an anchoring point and then adjust slightly in one direction instead of altering the view altogether. Moreover, once we reach an estimate that sounds satisfactory to us, we stop thinking and consider the problem solved. We have successfully captured the required point of view. That tendency is known as satisficing, a blend of sufficing and satisfying. A response bias that errs on the egocentric side of plausible answers to a given question. As soon as we find an answer that satisfies, we stop looking whether or not the answer is ideal or even remotely accurate. In a recent study of online behavior, for instance, individuals were profoundly influenced by existing personal preferences in their evaluations of websites, and they used those preferences as an anchor to reduce the number of sites they considered and to terminate their online search. As a result, they returned often to already known sites instead of taking the time to evaluate potential new sources of information. And they chose to focus on search engine summaries instead of using actual site visits to make their decisions. The tendency toward an egocentric bias and satisficing is especially strong when a plausible answer is presented early on in the search process. We then tend to consider our task complete, even if it's far from being so. A change in perspective, in physical location, quite simply forces mindfulness. It forces us to reconsider the world, to look at things from a different angle. And sometimes that change in perspective can be the spark that makes a difficult decision manageable, or that engenders creativity where none existed before. Consider a famous problem-solving experiment originally designed by Norman Meyer in 1931. A participant was placed in a room where two strings were hanging from the ceiling. The participant's job was to tie the two strings together. However, it was impossible to reach one string while holding the other. Several items were also available in the room, such as a pole, an extension cord, and a pair of pliers. What would you have done? Most participants struggled with the pole and the extension cord, trying their best to reach the end while holding on to the other string. It was tricky business. The most elegant solution? Tie the pliers to the bottom of one string, then use it as a pendulum and catch it as it floats toward you while you hold the other string. Simple, insightful, quick. But very few people could visualize the change in object use. Here, imagining the pliers as something other than pliers, a weight that could be tied to a string while embroiled in the task. Those that did one thing differently. They stepped back. They looked at it from a literal distance. They saw the whole and then tried to envision how they could make the details work. Some did this naturally. Some had to be prompted by the experimenter, who seemingly by accident brushed one of the strings to induce a swinging motion. That action was enough to get participants to spontaneously think of the plier solution. But none did it without a shift, however slight, of point of view. Or to speak in tropes terms, a move from the concrete, pliers, to the abstract, pendulum weight. From those puzzle pieces to the overall puzzle. Never underestimate how powerful a cue, physical perspective can be. As Holmes puts it in The Problem of Thor Bridge, once your point of view is changed, the very thing which was so damning becomes a clue to the truth. Distancing through mental techniques. Let's return for a moment to a scene that we've visited once before in The Hound of the Baskervilles. After Dr. Mortimer's initial visit, Dr. Watson leaves Baker Street to go to his club. Holmes, however, remains seated in his armchair, which is where Watson finds him when he returns to the flat around 9 o'clock in the evening. Has Holmes been a fixture there all day? Watson inquires. On the contrary, responds Holmes, I have been to Devonshire. Watson doesn't miss a beat. In spirit? He asks. Exactly, responds the detective. What is it exactly that Holmes does as he sits in his chair, his mind far away from the physicality of the moment? What happens in his brain, and why is it such an effective tool of the imagination, such an important element of his thought process that he hardly ever abandons it? Holmes's mental journeying goes by many names, but most commonly it is called meditation. When I say meditation, the images invoked for most people will include monks or yogis or some other spiritual-sounding monikers. But that is only a tiny portion of what the word means. Holmes is neither monk nor yoga practitioner, but he understands what meditation, in its essence, actually is. A simple mental exercise to clear your mind. Meditation is nothing more than the quiet distance that you need for integrative, imaginative, observant, and mindful thought. It is the ability to create distance, in both time and space, between you and all of the problems you are trying to tackle, in your mind alone. It doesn't even have to be, as people often assume, a way of experiencing nothing. Directed meditation can take you towards some specific goal or destination, like Devonshire, as long as your mind is clear of every other distraction. Or, to be more precise, as long as your mind clears itself of every distraction and continues to do so as the distractions continue to arise, as they inevitably will. In 2011, researchers from the University of Wisconsin studied a group of people who were not in the habit of meditating and instructed them in the following manner. Relax with your eyes closed and focus on the flow of your breath at the tip of your nose. If a random thought arises, acknowledge the thought and then simply let it go by gently bringing your attention back to the flow of your breath. For 15 minutes, the participants attempted to follow these guidelines. Then they were broken up into two groups. One group had the option of receiving 9 30-minute sessions of meditation instruction over the course of 5 weeks. And the other group had that option at the conclusion of the experiment, but not before. At the end of the 5 weeks, everyone completed the earlier thought assignment a second time. During each session, the researchers measured participants' electroencephalographic, EEG, activity, a recording of electrical activity along the scalp, and what they found presents a tantalizing picture. Even such a short training period, participants averaged between 5 and 16 minutes of training and practice a day, can cause changes at the neural level. The researchers were particularly interested in frontal EEG asymmetry, toward a pattern that has been associated with positive emotions and that has been shown to follow 70 or more hours of training in mindfulness meditation techniques. While prior to training, the two groups showed no differences, by the end of the study, those who had received additional training showed a leftward shift in asymmetry, which means a move toward a pattern that has been associated with positive and approach-oriented emotional states. Such states as have been linked repeatedly to increased creativity and imaginative capacity. What does that mean? First, unlike past studies of meditation that asked for a very real input of time and energy, this experiment did not require extensive resource commitment, and yet it still showed striking neural results. Moreover, the training provided was extremely flexible. People could choose when they would want to receive instruction and when they would want to practice. And perhaps more important, participants reported a spike in spontaneous passive practice when, without a conscious decision to meditate, they found themselves in unrelated situations thinking along the lines of the instructions that they had been provided. True, it is only one study, but there's more to the brain story than that. Earlier work suggests that meditation training can affect the default network, that diffuse attentional network that we've already talked about, that facilitates creative insights and allows our brains to work on remote connections while we're doing something else entirely. Individuals who meditate regularly show increased resting state functional connectivity in the network compared to non-meditators. What's more, in one study of meditation's effects over a period of 8 weeks, researchers found changes in gray matter density in a group of meditation-naive participants. That is, they hadn't practiced meditation before the beginning of the study, as compared to a control group. There were increases in concentration in the left hippocampus, the posterior cingulate cortex, PCC, the temporoparietal junction, TPJ, and the cerebellum, areas involved in learning and memory, emotional regulation, self-referential processing, and perspective-taking. Together, the hippocampus, PCC, and TPJ form a neural network that supports both self-projection, including thinking about the hypothetical future, and perspective-taking, or conceiving others' point of view. In other words, precisely the type of distancing that we've been discussing. Meditation is a way of thinking. A habit of distance that has the fortunate consequence of being self-reinforcing. One tool in the arsenal of mental techniques that can help you create the right frame of mind to attain the distance necessary for mindful, imaginative thought. It is far more attainable and far more widely applicable than the connotations of the word might have you believe. Consider the case of someone like Ray Dalio. Almost every morning, Dalio meditates. Sometimes he does it before work. Sometimes in his office, right at his desk. He leans back, closes his eyes, clasps his hands in a simple grip. Nothing more is necessary. "It's just a mental exercise in which you are clearing your mind," he once told a New Yorker in an interview. Dalio isn't the person that comes to mind most readily when you think of practitioners of meditation. He isn't a monk or a yoga fanatic or a hippie New Ager. And he isn't doing this just for the interest in participating in a psych study. He happens to be the founder of the world's biggest hedge fund, Bridgewater Associates, someone who has little time to waste and many ways to spend the time he does have. And yet he chooses, actively, to devote a portion of each day to meditation, in its broadest, most classic sense. When Dalio meditates, he clears his mind. He prepares it for the day by relaxing and trying to keep all of the thoughts that will proceed to bother him for the next however many hours at bay. Yes, it might seem like a waste to spend any time at all doing, well, nothing that looks productive. But spending those minutes in the space of his mind will actually make Dalio more productive, more flexible, more imaginative, and more insightful. In short, it will help him be a better decision maker. But is it for everyone? Meditation, that mental space, is not nothing. It requires real energy and concentration, hence the easier route of physical distance. While someone like Holmes or Dalio may well be able to dive right into blankness to great effect, I'm willing to bet that Watson would struggle. With nothing else to occupy his mind, his breathing alone would likely not be enough to keep all those thoughts in check. It's far easier to distance yourself with physical cues than it is to have to rely on your mind alone. Luckily, as I mentioned in passing, meditation need not be blank. In meditation, we can indeed be focusing on something as difficult to capture as breath or emotion or the sensations of the body to the exclusion of everything else. But we can also use what's known as visualization, a focus on a specific mental image that will replace the blankness with something more tangible and accessible. Go back for a moment to the Hound of the Baskervilles, where we left Holmes floating above the Devonshire moors. That, too, is meditation, and it wasn't at all aimless or blank or devoid of mental imagery. It requires the same focus as any meditation, but is in some ways more approachable. You have a concrete plan, something with which to occupy your mind and keep intrusive thoughts at bay, something on which you can focus your energy that is more vibrant and multidimensional than the rise and fall of your breath. And what's more, you can focus on attaining the distance that Trope would call hypotheticality to begin considering the ifs and what-ifs. Try this exercise. Close your eyes. Well, close them once you finish reading the instructions. Think of a specific situation where you felt angry or hostile. Your most recent fight with a close friend or a significant other, for instance. Do you have a moment in mind? Recall it as closely as you can, as if you were going through it again. Once you're done, tell me how you feel, and tell me as far as you can what went wrong. Who is to blame? Why? Do you think it's something that can be fixed? Close your eyes again. Picture the same situation. Only now, I want you to imagine that it is happening to two people who are not you. You are just a small fly on the wall, looking down at the scene and taking note of it. You are free to buzz around and observe from all angles, and no one will see you. Once again, as soon as you finish, tell me how you feel, and then respond to the same questions as before. You've just completed a classic exercise in mental distancing through visualization. It's a process of picturing something vividly, but from a distance, and so from a perspective that is inherently different from the actual one you have stored in your memory. From scenario one to scenario two, you have gone from a concrete to an abstract mindset. You've likely become calmer emotionally, seen things that you missed the first time around, and you may have even come away with a slightly modified memory of what happened. In fact, you may have even become wiser and better at solving problems overall, unrelated to the scenario in question. And you will have also been practicing a form of meditation. Sneaky, isn't it? Psychologist Ethan Cross has demonstrated that such mental distancing, the above scenario was actually taken from one of his studies, is not just good for emotional regulation. It can also enhance your wisdom, both in terms of dialectism, that is, being cognizant of change and contradictions in the world, and intellectual humility, that is, knowing your own limitations, and make you better able to solve problems and make choices. When you distance yourself, you begin to process things more broadly, see connections that you couldn't see from a closer vantage point. In other words, being wiser also means being more imaginative. It might not lead to a eureka moment, but it will lead to insight. You think as if you had actually changed your location while you remain seated in your armchair. Jacob Rabenow, an electrical engineer, was one of the most talented and prolific inventors of the 20th century. Among his 230 U.S. patents is the automatic letter sorting machine that the Postal Service still uses to sort the mail, a magnetic memory device that served as a precursor to the hard disk drive, and the straight-arm phonograph. One of the tricks that helps sustain his remarkable creativity and productivity? None other than visualization. As he once told psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, whenever a task proves difficult or takes time or doesn't have an obvious answer, I pretend I'm in jail. If I'm in jail, time is of no consequence. In other words, if it takes a week to cut this, it'll take a week. What else have I got to do? I'm going to be here for 20 years, see? This is a kind of mental trick. Otherwise, you say, my God, it's not working, and then you make mistakes. My way, you say time is of absolutely no consequence. Visualization helped Rabinow to shift his mindset to one where he was able to tackle things that would otherwise overwhelm him, providing the requisite imaginative space for such problem-solving to occur. The technique is widespread. Athletes often visualize certain elements of a game or move before they actually perform them, acting them out in their minds before they do so in reality. A tennis player envisions a serve before the ball has left his hand. A golfer sees the path of the ball before he lifts his club. Cognitive behavioral therapists use the technique to help people who suffer from phobias or other conditions to relax and be able to experience situations without actually experiencing them. Psychologist Martin Seligman urges that it might even be the single most important tool toward fostering a more imaginative, intuitive mindset. He goes as far as to suggest that by repeated, simulated visual enactment, intuition may be teachable virtually and on a massive scale. How's that for endorsement? It is all about learning to create distance with the mind by actually picturing a world as if you were seeing and experiencing it for real. As the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein once put it, to repeat, don't think, but look. That is the essence of visualization. Learning to look internally, to create scenarios and alternatives in your mind, to play out non-realities as if they were real. It helps you see beyond the obvious, to not make the mistakes of a Lestrade or a Gregson by playing through only the scenario that is in front of you, or the only one you want to see. It forces imagination because it necessitates the use of imagination. It's easier than you might think. In fact, all it is really is what we do naturally when we try to recall a memory. It even uses the same neural network, the MPFC, lateral temporal cortex, medial and lateral parietal lobes, and the medial temporal lobe, home of the hippocampus. Except, instead of recalling a memory exactly, we shuffle around details from experience to create something that never actually occurred, be it a not-yet-extant future or a counterfactual past. We test it in our minds instead of having to experience it in reality. And by so doing, we attain the very same thing we do by way of physical distance. We separate ourselves from the situation we are trying to analyze. It is all meditation of one form or another. When we saw Holmes in the Valley of Fear, he asked for a physical change in location, an actual prompt for his mind from the external world. But the same effect can be accomplished without having to go anywhere, from behind your desk, if you're Dalio, or your armchair, if you're Holmes, or wherever else you might find yourself. All you have to do is be able to free up the necessary space in your mind. Let it be the blank canvas. And then the whole imaginative world can be your palette. Sustaining your imagination, the importance of curiosity and play. Once upon a time, Sherlock Holmes urged us to maintain a crisp and clean brain attic. Out with the useless junk, in with meticulously organized boxes that are uncluttered by useless paraphernalia. But it's not quite that simple. Why on earth, for instance, did Holmes in The Lion's Mane know about an obscure species of jellyfish in one warm corner of the ocean? Impossible to explain it by virtue of the stark criteria he imposes early on. As with most things, it is safe to assume that Holmes was exaggerating for effect. Uncluttered, yes, but not stark. An attic that contained only the bare essentials for your professional success would be a sad little attic indeed. It would have hardly any material to work with, and it would be practically incapable of any great insight or imagination. How did the jellyfish make its way into Holmes's pristine palace? It's simple. At some point, Holmes must have gotten curious, just like he got curious about the motets. Just like he gets curious about art long enough to try to convince Scotland Yard that his nemesis, Professor Moriarty, can't possibly be up to any good. Just as he says to Inspector MacDonald in The Valley of Fear, when the inspector indignantly refuses Holmes's offer of reading a book on the history of Manor House, "Breadth of view, my dear Mr. Mac, is one of the essentials of our profession. The interplay of ideas and the oblique uses of knowledge are often of extraordinary interest." Time and time again, Holmes gets curious, and his curiosity leads him to find out more. And that more is then tucked away in some obscure, but labeled, box in his attic. For that is basically what Holmes is telling us. Your attic has levels of storage. There is a difference between active and passive knowledge, those boxes that you need to access regularly and as a matter of course, and those that you may need to reach one day but don't necessarily look to on a regular basis. Holmes isn't asking that we stop being curious, that we stop acquiring those jellyfish. No, he asks that we keep the active knowledge clean and clear, and that we store the passive knowledge cleanly and clearly in properly labeled boxes and bins, in the right folders and the right drawers. It's not that we should all of a sudden go against his earlier admonition and take up our precious mental real estate with junk. Not at all. Only, we don't always know when something that may at first glance appear to be junk-like is not junk at all, but an important addition to our mental arsenal. So, we must tuck those items away securely in case of future use. We don't even need to store the full item, just a trace of what it was. A reminder that will allow us to find it again. Just as Holmes looks up the jellyfish particulars in an old book rather than knowing them as a matter of course. All he needs to do is remember that the book and the reference exist. An organized attic is not a static attic. Imagination allows you to make more out of your mind space than you otherwise could. And the truth is, you never quite know what element will be of most use and when it might end up being more useful than you ever thought possible. Here, then, is Holmes's all-important caveat. The most surprising of articles can end up being useful in the most surprising of ways. You must open your mind to new inputs, however unrelated they may seem. And that is where your general mindset comes in. Is there a standing openness to inputs, no matter how strange or unnecessary they might seem, as opposed to a tendency to dismiss anything that is potentially distracting? Is that open-minded stance your habitual approach, the way that you train yourself to think and to look at the world? With practice, we might become better at sensing what may or may not prove useful, what to store away for future reference, and what to throw out for the time being. Something that at first glance may seem like simple intuition is actually far more, a knowledge that is actually based on countless hours of practice, of training yourself to be open, to integrate experiences in your mind until you become familiar with the patterns and directions those experiences tend to take. Remember those remote association experiments where you had to find a word that could complete all three members of a set? In a way, that encapsulates most of life. A series of remote associations that you won't see unless you take the time to stop, to imagine, and to consider. If your mindset is one that is scared of creativity, scared to go against prevailing customs and mores, it will only hold you back. If you fear creativity, even subconsciously, you will have more difficulty being creative. You will never be like Holmes, try as you may. Never forget that Holmes was a renegade, and a renegade that was as far from a computer as it gets. And that is what makes his approach so powerful. Holmes gets to the very heart of the matter in The Valley of Fear when he admonishes Watson that there should be no combination of events for which the wit of man cannot conceive an explanation. Simply as a mental exercise, without any assertion that it is true, let me indicate a possible line of thought. It is, I admit, mere imagination, but how often is imagination the mother of truth?